Have you ever heard, the answer is a low histamine diet. Cut this out, cut that out, and you'll feel better. Or have you heard, stress can make it worse? Well, my friends, get ready to learn the truth about low histamine diets for mast cell disease and why, yes, you should care more about stress. You're listening to The Itch, a podcast exploring all things allergy, asthma, and immunology.
So we've heard of these low histamine diets, and oftentimes patients will come in asking about low histamine diets for multiple allergic conditions, but specifically for mast cell disease, what do you think about them and where do you think they fall?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one thing that, and I'm not exactly sure how the signals get crossed a little, if you have mast cell activation syndrome, your mast cells are producing histamine and that's where the trouble is. And so taking less histamine is not going to change anything because if your mast cells make histamine, then that's where the problem is. And there certainly, you know, might be foods that might make your mast cells degranulate more, you know, fillers and things like that, like sulfite or other sort of things like that. It's not that you have a problem with metabolizing histamine or responding to histamine. It's just that your mast cells are making too much. Whereas when someone goes on a low histamine diet, it's because the histamine themselves is what they feel like they're not tolerating for really pretty much the same type of reason that you might be lactose intolerant. You're not allergic to that in any way, shape, or form, but your body has a hard time breaking down the lactose and you can get abdominal discomfort from not being able to break down lactose. Here also, you're having a difficult time breaking down histamine that can be naturally in foods and that most of us completely ignore because we have an enzyme that breaks it down. It's called thiamine oxidase, and it breaks down histamine. There are a small number of folks who actually do have a deficiency in thiamine oxidase. Either they were born with it or kind of like lactose intolerance where they're not making enough, or maybe the microbiome that they have doesn't make enough of it, because that also can happen. And those folks will, in those rare cases, when they eat foods with histamine in them, they can have GI issues and they even also can have systemic issues like flushing, because the histamine, which normally gets metabolized super, super fast, is now coursing through and causing trouble. It's for those folks that a low histamine diet would be most beneficial, or there are supplements, thiamine oxidase supplements exist for those folks who might take it like you would take Lactaid before eating a dairy meal if you had lactose intolerance. Some people have tried a thiamine oxidase with meals that can help if they have histamine intolerance. The problems are there are no tests that people do that are approved and validated tests to see if you have that. We're a little bit back to trial and error. There have been trials where people have done research-based tests to show that the thiamine oxidase is low, and then to show that by, you know, either going on a low histamine diet or taking thiamine oxidase is beneficial to them. It's not totally amazing, the results of those trials, but those have been done. And so, yeah, I have people who come in and say, oh, I do much better when I'm on a low histamine diet. And I say, fine, as long as you're getting good nutrition. You know, again, I don't know for sure that it isn't that you've eliminated something else that's causing a problem. I can't test for that either. But if it works, great. If it doesn't work, you'll know immediately. It's not something that builds up or anything like that. It's an immediate type of a thing. So again, it's a trial and error thing. I have not found, and actually the evidence does not bear out, but most people who are worried they might have histamine intolerance don't. But that would be the reason that one would try the low histamine diet, is because of a concern for intolerance, not because they have allergies or idiopathic MCAS or mastocytosis.
Yeah, and I think that's essentially what I tend to tell patients too. And I also just put food in context, that food is supposed to be something that we enjoy, something that we have to do for our sustenance, for staying alive. And so we don't want to create anxiety around food as much as possible. So that's why things that haven't been proven don't necessarily show efficacy, we want to try not to put those into the mix, because it's just going to make something that should be enjoyable, something that we have to do, have a little bit more anxiety around it. That's just one other thing that I like to point out to people, is that there's lots of things out there that you could try. If you want to try it for a short period of time, we're totally okay with that. But just remember, there might be other factors involved too that you might change at the same time. So if you are going to try one of these diets, do it at a time that you're not just about to start a new medication, for example. Do it in isolation of other things that you're trying for these conditions, so that it doesn't get confused and that you're not on a diet that may or may not be helping.
Totally. And again, you know, that goes like with the stepwise thing, right? You know, like we were talking about, don't introduce all the medications at one time. And again, it could be a stepwise thing. If you were worried about histamine intolerance, you could start that one first. And again, if it works, there's no role for the other stuff because that's where the problem was, right? To keep that in mind. Agreed that one can read a lot about anecdotes, but I think also if one speaks to enough of us who see these folks, you'll hear sometimes it works, not that often if I look across the board. And also it's one of those things where you will know immediately it's not like a solid type of a thing. So that's as opposed to waiting for the thing to work. And in the meantime, worrying about everything and anything.
I feel like I've seen so much online of people just experimenting with these diets. Do you think that if someone's like serious about it, should they talk to their doctor before they attempt a low histamine diet so they just get a kind of a guideline? Or is it something you could just do on their own?
It's hard. I think a lot of docs are going to have a hard time knowing what the right answer is to that. So I think if I said, go talk to your doc, I might get tomatoes thrown at me when I'm walking around the street after this. In a lot of cases, I think that you want to make sure you have adequate nutrition. And so whoever your healthcare provider is who would be well-versed enough to be able to tell you that you've got good nutrition, however it is that you would change a diet, that's the most important thing to me. And then the other point, of course, would just be how will you know if it's working versus not working? But one wants to try it as long as it is nutritionally sound, like any other diet you might go on that you want to make sure is nutritionally sound. That's the check. And then the other check is just how will I know that this is actually helping me?
And then Josh, is there a place that you know actually has a good list of a low histamine diet? Because I don't tend to recommend it in my clinic at all. And I'm just not sure if there's a validated resource or how they even determine if foods are high or low in histamine.
So there certainly are plenty of lists which are correct to say that they are higher in histamine or lower in histamine. Like I think those resources from reputable websites are correct. A specific diet, that you are going to do, I don't know there that we have like a validated resource which is like published somewhere in general. However, there are diets that people have used in clinical trials, right? So one could look at what was written in those clinical trials and see that was something that people tried. Were those diets that were picked, are we sure that they have been checked by a nutritionist, that those were good, solid, and sound diets? I don't know the answer to that question. You might have hoped an institutional review board that reviews trials would make sure that this was a safe diet to be on. So I would assume so. What's in those papers, when they've actually done a proper randomized trial, they do have those lists, and that would be a good resource. That might be something where the doc says, okay, I'll hold this one for you and vet that this looks like it was decent enough. But I think in practice, most people just look at top 10 lists and, the same way that people do low FODMAPs. That stuff is out there.
And then I think lastly, I wanted to just talk about stress management and how you think that plays a role for patients with mast cell disease, mastocytosis and idiopathic mast cell activation syndrome, and just talk about what you know and what the research says.
Thank you for asking me that. I wanted to make sure that we're addressing that. I can't underscore how important that question is, and to make it as clear as possible. If I took stress hormone and I purified stress hormone and I dropped it on anyone's mast cell, pretty much in a petri dish, I will make it many times easier for that mast cell to release histamine and everything else, right? Essentially, you bring the threshold down. When you have stress hormones released in your body, you make it easier for a mast cell to degranulate. So we can talk about this being in your head or not being in your head. I'm talking about the hormone that's getting released because of whatever stress it was that you got. And actually, it's pretty clear that it's tends to be psychological stress more than physical, like pain and things like that. The pain might lead you to be stressed about getting more pain and released, but that tends to be the psychological stress is what will release these types of stress hormones. And then these types of stress hormones and other things like neuropeptides that get released by nerves themselves in the skin and elsewhere, those will make it easier for the mast cell to degranulate. They will also mess with your body's ability to remain in homeostasis, your autonomic function, to keep you from getting palpitations, to keep you from getting a terrible bad belly because you're nervous about something. Mast cells are doing it, and so are other nerves that are starting this stress response. And there actually are clinical trials proving that psychological stress, you can have your gut become more permeable to everything, which is what happens usually in IBS, and that in certain forms of IBS, and that can be blocked by giving chromalin to patients. So this is a pretty solid thing, and it's a pretty important thing. And when we say stress, we're talking about medical stress, which is the release of these stress hormones. And so it is absolutely critical. We also know that probably the most common reason anybody gets hives is stress, not allergies to anything. I don't really hardly ever test anybody who comes in with hives that they can't explain. Yeah, but we know that one of the biggest triggers, even if it's an autoimmune reason, you have urticaria, chronic hives. The reason you flare, again, stress tends to be the most one. And I think anybody who has eczema knows that they itch more when they have more stress. And that's all, again, very physiologic. What's, I think your body's trying to help you there, but it ain't working out so well. Doing all sorts of things to try and avoid stress is important. Obviously, you can't get stressed about avoiding stress, but it is an integral part of anyone's care for this type of a thing that no drug is going to really be able to help. The drugs will take the edges off of certain things. You know, there are folks who have done some trials using meditation, using mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, all of which can be very, very helpful, and where really the antihistamines are sort of your bridge to really being able to achieve control over the stress, which then actually stops the snowballing that can happen with a lot of the symptoms that go on. I should even add that regular allergy is no question that either the individual or in the case of children, paternal stress contributes to the severity of their reactions to regular amounts of whatever it is that they're being exposed to. It's a real thing that needs to be always a part of the self-care that's happening that is very difficult to manage any other way besides behavioral techniques for being able to de-stress. So I think that it's such a critical thing. And I really do think it's ignored for the most part. It's either dismissed as it's all in your head, or it's dismissed as it's not at all in your head. And why are you thinking about this instead of it's both? And, you know, as crazy as it seems, there's no doubt that that interaction is there and that we need to do more to come up with even better ways to deal with stress-induced mast cell issues and allergy issues that we see all the time. I'd like to say for some folks, it's not the peanut you ate, it's what the person said to you while you were eating it. I mean, that really is. I'm sure, Dr. Gupta, you probably said that in some form or another to folks. And I think sometimes healthcare providers are scared to say it out loud. And I think that's really problematic. I think that it's absolutely critical.
I think that the way that I talk about it with patients is just that in every single condition, we know that there's a huge mind-body connection. And I think that what you're talking about with those stress hormones and mast cells, I think that could probably be applied to every single disorder in our human body. But any condition is amplified. We know that with asthma, that stress and anxiety can trigger asthma attacks. We know that with so many different conditions that stress and anxiety just cause a spiraling effect. And so I think it's just important to treat those underlying depression, anxiety, any of those conditions that may be underlying in people definitely need to be treated in addition to whatever chronic condition, for example, mast cell disease. Again, I think that we don't have enough of that probably going on. And unfortunately, a lot of people suffer from anxiety, depression, and other stress disorders. And so we just need to keep that in mind always.
I want to add to it because, you know, I do want to make clear that there certainly have plenty of folks. So without a doubt, you know, that anxiety and depressive disorders certainly can potentially make it worse. And those do need to be addressed. But there are plenty, plenty, plenty of patients who do not have an anxiety or depressive disorder, don't need treatment for it, aren't going to, you know, whatever. I did have one patient who told me that Xanax was the best antihistamine she ever took. That's the outlier. I actually find that there are folks who don't necessarily have a disorder, but they are fully capable of producing stress hormones. I want to make sure that folks don't get the impression that we think that the only way, you know, that you must have anxiety or depression, that's where that stress is coming from. Certainly that has to be dealt with. But there's also, you know, the de-stressing that every one of us needs to do always. And that is certainly what I'm talking about addressing. Again, usually not pharmacological.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Remember that all information you hear today is for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified physician or healthcare provider. And also, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. And if you have a second, help spread the word by rating our podcast and sharing with your friends and family who might also be interested in learning more about allergies, asthma, and immunology. You can always stay up to date by checking out our Instagram, The Itch Podcast, where you can leave questions you are itching to know, or check out our website, which is
itchpodcast.com, which contains more information about the subjects we covered in today's episode and every episode. Until next time, have a fabulous week.